The problem that I want to talk about is belongs to a very large and, you know, very well-known family of problems that usually is described as Hodge decompositions. What you want to do is you want to, you know, given an open set that I'm going to take smooth for this talk, and the vector field that I'm going to assume square integrable, although I'll make different assumptions later on. What I look for are a vector field, a function, and a harmonic vector field that actually do this trick. You just want to basically split, you know, some given data as a curl, a gradient, and a harmonic vector field. By harmonic, I mean that its curl and its divergence are both zero. As I said, this is a very old problem. Rather than give you, you know, a lot of references, let me just point out roughly what you get. You get that L2 actually can be split basically as a direct sum of three things. With appropriate boundary conditions, you can actually make even that an orthogonal decomposition. And the three terms in the decomposition are just a space of gradients, a space of curls, and a space of harmonic vector fields. So in some sense, this problem, you can, you know, roughly speaking, always solve it. The Hodge decomposition, you can always basically just find the decomposition that I'm looking for. Yeah, the boundary conditions affect the decomposition. There is some obvious non-uniqueness. For example, if you actually look at the decomposition that I wrote at the beginning, you can add any gradient to this vector, any gradient to this vector field, and you still get basically the same thing, right? So when you talk about uniqueness, you have to be a little careful. You have to, besides imposing boundary conditions, perhaps impose some sort of divergence condition on B and things like that in order to get uniqueness. Now, if you do that, you can definitely get, you know, a bit sharper on the description, but very loosely speaking, you can always do it. So this Hodge decomposition is something that, you know, is very well studied. You can even do it in places like Riemannian manifolds and things. So, you know, you don't even need to be in a flat plane to actually do this kind of a thing. The problem that I want to consider is actually of this family, but actually uses a sort of a weight function. I'm going to consider a function rho that's pretty much like the distance function to the boundary, so it vanishes linearly on the boundary. And I would like to actually consider this decomposition with particularly the rho dividing like it appears here. You can actually rewrite this system, you know, and put it like this, which is basically the same system that I want to actually solve. And this actually comes from a physics problem that I was studying. So the motivation to actually just divide this by that is not because I like to see things blow up, but rather because of a specific application that I have in mind. And the problem, of course, is kind of natural. I mean, this function rho actually vanishes on the boundary. So it doesn't look a priori like, you know, it's not very clear what to do, or at least I didn't know what to do when I first actually came across this problem. The existence of weak solutions to such a Hodge decomposition problem is not really a big deal. You can just, for example, minimize a function like this among, you know, among particular functions and vector and harmonic vector fields, and you can always get, you know, some sort of decomposition for this relatively quickly. The problem is the kind of regularity that you can obtain because of the application that I have in mind. I need relatively a lot of regularity. And for example, if you actually just minimize that thing, and you try and see what kind of equation you get for the function phi. The equation actually looks like this, and the function rho that I took to vanish on the boundary appears actually in the ellipticity constant over here. In some sense, to actually understand the problem, the Hodge decomposition problem with the division weight that I showed before, it would be enough for me to actually answer this question. If you have a C0 alpha function, say, on your domain, and you actually consider this equation, what can you say about the function phi? How regular will phi be? You can rewrite this equation by just, you know, using the divergence operator and applying it to the various functions. You can rewrite it like this. So the function rho appears actually dividing here. And by the conditions that I'm assuming on this weight function, let me just show you the previous slide for a second. Because I'm assuming that actually it vanishes like the distance to the boundary, like that. This is really basically, you know, like the gradient of a logarithm in a sense. So, yeah, that's exactly the point. And the point is, you know, rho vanishes on the boundary, so this guy in some sense is parallel to the normal on the boundary, which means that in some sense this is sort of an extra derivative that you're taking, a derivative in the direction of the normal to the boundary. It's not exactly a nice term to handle. That's sort of the point of this talk in a sense. Now these problems with elliptic with degenerate ellipticity actually are relatively have been studied before. Just a couple comments on them. There's relatively a lot of work. For example, if you assume that the weight, that the inverse of the weight has some integrability, for example, can be integrated to the power beta for beta bigger than or equal than 1, then there is some regularity that you can obtain for that equation. On the other hand, if you knew that you had a solution that was 0 alpha a priori, then you can also say a few things. There's a paper from, I think, 86 or something by these three guys where they actually analyzed this situation. Now, the problem for me is that I basically can obtain a weak solution to this degenerate elliptic problem. My startup point is only this integrability condition. I don't really know whether the thing is D0 alpha a priori. Also, if one is actually willing to change the metric in which you consider the Holder continuity and things like that, or regularity for this equation, you can actually get a lot. There's a lot for what people call Carnot-Cassiodori metrics that are basically a ton of metrics determined by this quadratic function here that depends on the weight. So if you're willing to change your metric, you can save quite a bit. But the problem, again, that I have in mind, the application in particular, I would like to have everything written down in terms of just Euclidean metrics. So I would like to actually know the regularity of this equation with respect to just standard inner product in R3 in particular. And here's a result about this particular problem. Turns out that if you consider this equation and you consider the data to be Z0 alpha, I'm not sure I wrote it at the beginning, and you take a function rho that vanishes like the distance to the boundary, you can always get a fair amount of regularity for this equation. Even you can actually put a power k, any integer bigger than or equal than 1, and you can still get, sort of the classical result that if the input is Z0 alpha, then the result is Z2 alpha. The reason for this result is actually rather simple in some sense. You see, when you want to consider this thing, it's actually perhaps easiest to, just to give you an idea of what the proof of this is, when you want to consider that problem, perhaps the easiest model case that you can think of is a half space that you can write as Rn minus 1 cross an interval like 0 infinity. And as a function that actually is, comparable to the distance to the boundary, again, the simplest possible case is just take in this half space the last coordinate. The equation can be rewritten like this in that case. And you see, if you're actually in this place, these two coordinates don't really interact with each other. So the equation splits. And what happens is that... Oh, open interval. You mean this one?
Yeah, open interval.
Yeah. I tend to use these just to avoid the confusion with ordered pairs. That's what I mean. Yeah. Sorry about that. I just grew up seeing the thing with the brackets like that, so it's hard for me to get away from that. Anyway, so what I was trying to say is that when you actually consider this particular set, if you wanted to show some regularity for that equation, in the model case of a half space with this particular function rho with this weight, this equation looks like this. And because these two variables don't really interact with each other at all, the equation splits like this. Splits into that equation over there with some derivatives, in particular the Laplacian on the left, only with respect to the first n plus 1, n minus 1 variables, and then some derivatives on the last variables. But you see, that equation, even though it doesn't quite look like it, is really Poisson's equation. And the reason for it to be Poisson's equation is that you can actually, for example, consider, you can consider a different problem in this dimension, n plus k, where n comes from the previous problem, and k is the power in that degeneracy there. And if you actually, for example, consider a point P in Rn plus k, and split it as, some x prime in Rn minus 1, and some z in RK plus 1 and take a function of all these variables that happens to be exactly radial of the last variables rather than radial in everything, you compute its Laplace and it looks exactly like this. Turns out that, you know, if you identify this RZ here with XN in the equation above, then these two equations are exactly the same. So the degenerate problem that I wanted to study is really just Poisson's equation in a different dimension. Well, you know, there's a cost to pay in a different dimension. But nevertheless, it's just Poisson's equation. The only thing you have to take in mind is that in this extended problem with extended dimension, a function is radial in some variables, and that, you know, I suppose it's enough to actually give all the regularities that I need from this problem. So in the end, this problem ends up being relatively simple. Yes, I don't know how to do this without that condition, of course. I don't know. Bob, for example, mentioned a ton of interpolation tricks that one might think to actually prove the regularity, you know, when you're between integers. And also, there's another question. If you actually let me show you the equation that I had at the beginning. You see, I always assume that rho here vanishes like a single power of the distance to the boundary, right? I mean, I don't want this thing to vanish faster here than there. So I don't know how to get away from that either. Right, exactly. Sorry. Yeah, the thing changes, you know, vanishes at various different rates on the boundary. I don't know how to do that. But in this particular case, when the rate is very, very, you know, very limited and actually integer valued, the problem turns out to be rather simple. Now, what I actually was aiming at is actually using this problem to consider a Hodge decomposition for vector fields that I need to assume that are at least C2, again, because of the problem that I'm, you know, because of an application that I have in mind. And the regularity for the previous degenerate equation allows me basically to solve this Hodge decomposition for a given V0. Basically like this, you can obtain a function S0 and a vector field B0 and a harmonic vector field that actually do this, that satisfy this equation. And the vector field and B0 and S0 are actually quite smooth. H0 here is a harmonic vector field, so you can choose it very smooth if you choose appropriate boundary conditions. I mean, a harmonic vector field, let me just remind you here, that's this. Its curl and its divergence are zero. So if you impose appropriate boundary conditions on this guy will be really very smooth. It's not a problem. The problem are more S0 and B0, and we can get them very smooth. And there's another fact that here is sort of important, technically important for the application that I have in mind, that you can choose B0 on the right to actually vanish quadratically, vanish relatively fast. This is going to be important because there's some error terms in the application that I want to consider that depend relatively crucially on this thing vanishing quadratically. Now, the application that I have in mind is an application to this energy functional that I'm going to actually write here to refer to it a little later, perhaps on the other side. So this is an energy functional in all of our three. Plus A over 2 epsilon squared mod U squared, there's a divided by 2 over here, plus mod U to the power 4 over I think, and then there's parentheses there. So this is an energy functional that actually comes from a physical model. People usually consider it when modeling, physicists consider it when modeling these things called Bose-Einstein condensates. This is a kind of condensed matter, very peculiar, that arises in some super cold gases. From a mathematical point of view, this energy represents the particular energy of the following situation. You have a potential A. So suppose this is some sort of potential A of X. And you have the condensate trapped in here. And then the vector field V that appears here represents some sort of steering. So you have a small propeller actually rotating inside this thing. And this expression over here represents the energy of the condensate in this potential and being stirred by this particular vector field V sub epsilon. Epsilon here is a small parameter. This actually has more like a physical interpretation that depends a little bit on where you actually read about this energy. And I'm interested in this particular energy under this constraint. This constraint in some sense means that you have a fixed amount of condensate, or that the amount of condensate you get in this situation is sort of given to you. I would like to actually try and analyze this equation as epsilon goes to zero. And it turns out that, for example, here I'm going to assume a couple conditions. I'm going to assume that this goes to, that the potential does this. It goes to infinity as x goes to infinity, which in terms of this picture means that this potential is completely trapping. So the walls actually become so tall that nothing can ever escape out of this thing. What one imagines about this energy is that if the potential, sorry, if the stirring is not too strong, like if you're not going at the thing too hard, this thing will actually sort of tend to accumulate itself in the lowest potential region. We'll just try and go to the bottom. And in order, you know, to actually say what the bottom is, you take, first of all, the set of points where A is less than lambda for some particular level that, you know, needs to be determined. So, you know, we consider the region where we're below this, and we call that omega. And then we're going to define a function rho exactly as lambda minus A plus. Turns out to actually, you know, one can analyze this problem, but one of the things that actually appears is that in the middle of this problem, you actually have to solve this Hodge decomposition, which is the problem that I was, you know, talking about a little while ago. And there are a few papers, actually, for this particular problem of this energy, but they are actually written down considering particular, very specific potential, particularly this sort of quadratic potential, and this kind of a vector field that's just, you know, circling basically around a vertical axis. And it turns out that for this potential and that vector field, you can actually find this Hodge decomposition rather explicitly. I mean, explicitly. And with that particular explicit solution for this Hodge decomposition and this, several tools that actually were developed in the study of a different energy called Ginzburg-Landau can be applied to this situation. It turns out that the studies in particular in this case that were done for that particular vector field V that I showed you before don't really depend on the particular form of the vector field V, but rather on having some properties of the Hodge decomposition. So let me see, where can I write this? So the Hodge decomposition that I have is of this form. Turns out that to reproduce some of the results that particularly, for example, Bob Girard did for this energy, for more general fields, you really just need to understand very well or relatively well what that Hodge decomposition does. Particularly, one would like to know that the vector field B that appears there vanishes rather fast on the boundary, at least quadratically, which is one thing that we can actually obtain. You can actually use all this technology that was, you know, developed by other people and apply it to this energy, to the energy E epsilon that I have over there, as epsilon goes to zero, and you obtain this kind of a gamma limit. Here, by this gamma, I mean a Lipschitz curve that actually is without boundary. There's an N missing here in boundary. Anyways, it's a curve that actually, I'm assuming, without boundary in omega, and that somehow represents, see, once you actually start stirring this condensate, what physicists expect is that at some point, whirlpools will appear inside of here. Whirlpools that somehow mean, you know, there's a little bit of some rotation around with, particularly with some degree, with some non-zero degree, around some curve in the condensate. And this energy over here, roughly speaking, represents the cost of having a vortex located around the curve gamma inside of your condensate. The vector field B that appears here in this energy is the one that comes from the Hodge decomposition of the V that I have over here. So you see, having, you know, being able to do this is sort of, you know, kind of an important step in the middle of the whole thing. One can use, for example, the analysis of this energy to produce local minimizers of the original energy. This has been done by Bob Girard, also with Stan Alama and Leah Bronsart. We considered a similar problem. And you end up getting, you know, kind of a neat situation where you can basically say, well, if you actually find the local minimizer of this limiting energy, you end up with some curve, and then you know that the situation, the Bose-Einstein condensate will actually have local minimizers with vortices very close to this curve. So in some sense, you can almost prescribe the vortices. Not quite exactly that, but almost there. Just a few words about this limiting energy. If you actually compute, if you compute the Euler Lagrange equation for this energy on curves, for these vortices, you end up with the following equation. The equation over there, this is an ODE, it's an ODE system, and has been studied before in some particular geometries, specifically for the vector field V that appears here, and the potential A that I showed you before, so the quadratic potential that you can write as x squared plus y squared plus z squared. Turns out that the domain omega that I refer here as the lowest potential region for that potential is pretty much a sphere, or you know, some sort of an ellipsoid. And you can actually use the symmetry of the domain to reduce the problem, at least this study problem over here, to you know, reduce it to a problem in two dimensions rather than three. So there are some studies about these critical points, but I don't think they actually kind of use exactly that equation. This is something that we've been doing in joint work lately with Ben Stevens, another postdoc here. And we know a few things about the critical points. Particularly, we know one thing that I find rather striking, which is that in the energy for these vortices, you see, the term that actually counts for the length of the curves is like this. And there's this function rho in front that vanishes on the boundary. So one could imagine having perhaps, where do you need the eraser? One could imagine perhaps having a curve inside of your condensate. Suppose this is the lowest potential region, what I'm calling omega. One could imagine having a curve that actually lingers a long time near the border. Because since this weight is actually very close to zero, having a long length near the boundary doesn't really even count. Turns out that that cannot happen. The length of this curve is actually finite, even if you forget to put the weight in front. And furthermore, these curves actually don't like to do that, but rather, when they actually hit the boundary, they like to hit to get away from it as fast as they can. So, anyway, there's several other problems here that, you know, are still open, some of them being considered by, again, Bob and Almut and myself, but I think I'm running out of time, so I'll thank you very much for your attention right now.